This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harrell.
Welcome to another edition of the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Jim Harrell. I hope you had a great Halloween. You know, we just had Halloween past, and boy, do we have a big event coming up in a couple of days here. Of course, I'm speaking about, for the Americans in the audience, our big presidential election. And we thought it would be a lot of fun to have somebody who talks about predictions and prophecy. And I'm talking, of course, about our guest tonight, John Hoag. Now, John defines himself as a rogue scholar. He's traveled the world three times. He's studied meditation disciplines. He's reported on new religious movements, cults, and he's compiled a reference of the world's prophecies concerning the future of humankind entering a new millennium. Now, he's considered a world authority on Nostradamus and other prophetic traditions, and he is critically acclaimed for his ability to cut through the social, religious, and nationalistic projections of prophets and their interpreters to find threads of insight they all share. He's received wide international recognition, and he's been on many TV and radio shows, Coast to Coast, Unsolved Mysteries, The View, and it is our great pleasure to have him on our show tonight. And he's also an author of 13 books thus far, with 1.3 million in print in 18 different languages. His latest book is called Nostradamus and the Antichrist. John Hoag, thank you for joining us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me on in our inauguration day show, our first show.
Yes, yes. And I must say, you know, it is a very, it's a time rich with a lot of speculation about what's coming up. You know, the America is under great turmoil with the economy and the election coming up, and we have 2012 coming up. So it's probably a very rich time to be in your line of work, isn't it?
Oh, very much so. It's a something that I anticipated, since I'm a prognosticator, I should anticipate, I suppose, that this would happen. I write an annual book, a digital download book called Predictions for the Said Year. And the first one of those was Predictions for 2008, which is posted at hoagprophecy.com. And that's my website. And it's such a significant year that I had to write a whole book about it. And I was surprised to see that a lot of what I said has come to pass. Unfortunately, some of the negatives, but also some of the positives. What has come to pass is more significant is that I said back in December of 2007, at a time when not too many people were seeing even a recession, I said there would be a very deep recession in 2008. And I said that it would take about 2 years to sort out. And if it sorted out, we would recover a different economy, never going back to what we had before. But it would settle out, and we would then have a better situation. Or it could plunge into a global depression. So the next 2 years, starting with this pivotal year of 2008, is so significant as a launch-off time in prophecy. And one of the reasons why is this year in our normal, regular Judeo-Christian calendar happens to be the turning point between the Piscean Age and the Aquarian Age. And it's related to an ancient calendar clock that was used in Mesopotamia called the Grand Cosmic Year. And what that means is every time the vernal equinox position of the sun returns after 12 months going through the tropical constellations of the zodiac back to its vernal equinox point, it precedes or retrogrades slightly to a different position. And one of the reasons why back in the late 1500s we had to change the Gregorian calendar and add, or I guess we had to mess around with some days, we had to lose some days, because we had gained that much time to where the vernal equinox, see, if this is not done, then you might have some era in the future where vernal equinox happens in December and in the dead of winter. So it is a, or December becomes spring, more like.
Sure.
And so it has to be changed. Now, given that measurement, It takes roughly 25,600 years for the sun to go back to its original position in the sky related to us on the surface of the planet, to pass through all 12 signs of the zodiac. That means that these signs become cosmic months. That means it takes roughly 2,000 years for the sun to progress, precede its course through each constellation. We just finished a month this year, the cosmic month called the Piscean Age. We are just beginning the cosmic month called the Aquarian Age. But more than this, history has a beat, a rhythm, and the smallest temporal measurement in the cosmic clock is, you could call it the upbeat, the kind of assertive yang male beat, which is 36 years long. And then the downbeat, which is 36 years, this is the night yin intuitive, 36 years long. So back in 1973, 36 years ago, 72-73, we entered what is called Cosmic Day. And what that means is that a whole lot of things happened in 72-73 that define the course of history for the next 36 years.
Watergate
for one. The coming of Eastern religious thought literally to this country, America, from the East. So there was good things as well. There was Watergate, which was actually a 36-year plunge into a losing faith with government. You had a number of other things as well. You also had the emergence of international terrorism from the Middle East around that time, 72-73, Munich. You also had the Yom Kippur War, which basically triggered a change in the beginning of the Palestinian-Israeli peace process through Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin getting together because of that war a few years later, created a situation to change the situation. So it's a key thing. It also was the year of the period of the first major oil embargo. It's also the last time we were in such a recession, and with stagflation and inflation, these things potentially looming, that happened then. Nixon started floating the dollar in the economy, had not been done before.
Mm-hmm.
I could cite many, many, many things.
Well, and Nixon was the one that largely, in some ways, went off the gold standard, wasn't he?
Yeah. He started floating the economy, the dollar, and that actually helped us get out of, started the motion in that period of us getting out of a recession. It also was the time when the EPA was created. It was a time when people began publicly to become aware of ecological impact on the earth on a mass level that had not been seen before. The green movement revolution began around the early 70s. So a lot of things are initiated every 36 years, and when they're initiated in a cosmic day cycle, they tend to lean towards a more mental, male, husbanding insertion of history. When it moves into the feminine cosmic night cycle, history is more motivated by a mass emotional impulse. It is interesting to note, although this is a delicate thing to note because it's easy for people who, of course, are going to move with their emotions in history more than their reason. They might have a problem with this comparison, but in its essence, it's true that the last time we were in a 36-year cosmic night cycle, the person who was best noted for being a convincing speaker that could sway entire nations was Adolf Hitler. And he, as well, of course, as Winston Churchill and others who were able to draw up the emotions as the war came on, we have now today, just a short time from now, an election that will pick not only someone significant as a leader for the United States, but the leader of the president of the United States in many ways is the most powerful man still in the world and influences the course of history for the rest of the planet as well. And what we have, although not at all comparable in spirit to Adolf Hitler, certainly not, but you have a future president Barack Obama, who is also a very powerful speaker who has moved in this country the emotions of people towards him. And, you know, the person who can manipulate or inspire the emotions in a cosmic night cycle does not need to be an exploiter or a bad person. Good and great leaders can do the same thing. FDR, during the same cosmic night cycle, well, the previous one, was also able to stir the American people and guide them through a kind of warm, paternal way through his fireside chat theaters.
On radio, yes.
On radio. And so it is a... you start to see the patterns in history. So we are in a not only a 36-year change cycle, but this is the end of a cosmic month and the beginning of a new month. That means we're also entering at the end of November a Pluto in Capricorn transit of 18 years. The last time that the United States had this in its stars was back during the American Revolution, the Declaration of Independence.
Really?
It's a big thing. It's very big and karmic for America, especially after having 8 years of a president whose birth sign, his sun sign in Cancer, and America is also a sun sign in Cancer, both are born exactly 13 degrees Cancer. 13 is the number of America, 13 stars and stripes. And so it's numerologically significant, it's astrologically significant. And the thing that a lot of seers over time, especially the most famous of them, the French prophet from the 16th century, Nostradamus, used astrology as less of a science and more an intuitive art to be able to use the stars and their patterns and cycles as a language to indicate the patterns of history in the future, and also the birth charts of nations and movements and great leaders.
So based on what you've said, I mean, you said something very almost subtly, but so obviously at this point you're predicting, and I don't know if it's the polls or actually things that you've seen in prophecy, is it your prediction that we do have a President Obama in our future?
Yes, I have been since aware of him as the Black Kennedy, and declared him that in my Hope Prophecy bulletins and on radio and TV as far back as 2006 in August, after I saw him come off a plane and to greet a crowd of Kenyans in Africa. And there was something about him, and a little backstory about this. This is the 40th anniversary of my presidential predictions. I've been making them since 1968. I have been 10 and 0, and I use what I call cryptically my oracle, which is a state of deep relaxation through meditation that does not seek to do anything or make any predictions, but simply it's an aha moment, almost as if I'm looking at the TV and I see a hand that is resting on the shoulder of someone saying, for instance, back in 1992 during the Jennifer Flowers crisis for Bill Clinton, when he came in second in New Hampshire primary, I suddenly said to friends that we were watching his speech at the end of the primary, and when he's calling himself the comeback kid, I saw the hand, and I said, that's the two-term Democrat I was writing about in 1983. He's going to be the two-term Democrat. And he was. What has happened over the years of late since 2000 is some strange sidelines to this oracular experiment. Back in 2000, I had the first of what I call riddles come to me, where the message was almost as if Gandalf had spoken it to me, you know, speaking in riddles. And the message was, I said, I predict Al Gore is going to win by 500,000 popular vote. He's going to win, and I also know equally that I'm going to be wrong. I don't know how I can reconcile being absolutely right and absolutely wrong. And that's what I was saying. Yeah, and I didn't know. I couldn't figure it. I mean, I received the message, and then I send the message. And then, of course, the the mind field is when we all try to pick through the mind field of what that all means. And that's the treacherous next step of anybody who has a vision of the future, be them prophet or interpreter of prophets, or both. You have to make sense. It's like the pure water of the experience. It's like something that passes through the tea bag of your mind, your mm-hmm. projections, mm-hmm. your conditioning. And it comes out tainted. It cannot help but be tainted in a, when it comes into a polar, bipolar world, you might mm-hmm. say, a dialectical world. So, you know, we knew what happened in 2000, that Al Gore did win by 500,000 votes, but he lost the Electoral College in a disputed election in Florida. Now, Bush and Kerry, that was a lot easier, even though at the time I was thinking there's no way that Bush could win the way he was shooting himself in the foot in the debates four mm-hmm. years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But this oracular, very calm thing, no matter what my personal opinions are about people, and you can imagine, you know, there of all those people that I predicted as president, some of them were people I might have voted for, and some of them were people that I didn't vote for, but knew even if I voted against them, they were going to win.
Now, in terms of Obama, you see him becoming president. What do you foresee for an Obama presidency, both for him personally and for the nation?
Well, it is complicated, and I looked at it at the possibility in my predictions for 2008 book, because I, along with, because I'm now in another riddle. I had this message that said two presidents are running for the United States, two future presidents, and it was Obama and Hillary Clinton. And I'm thinking, oh, so here comes the attempt to, what does that mean? You know, I start to then put it through the tea strainer of my mind to come out with an answer. And the answers that I theorized here and there was, well, perhaps it means one is on the ticket of the other and some tragedy happens, or one goes first and then the other comes later after tragedy, or perhaps after just one term, if the presidency did not go as well as planned and hoped for. And so what I sense is, and at that time I said on shows that I felt that Hillary Clinton was going to win the primaries, and what actually happened again, this is the Al Gore effect, she did win the popular vote. If you collected all ballots cast in all 50 states and all provinces of America, she won an extra 174,000 votes over Obama,
mm-hmm.
but she did not win the delegates that were needed, that strategically was not positioned for her. And so in a way, it was a review of Al Gore winning 500,000 and losing. I started to think, well, maybe what my oracle does is all of these years is read the hearts and the ballots cast of those who vote. That doesn't always mean in close elections that the winner, that I'm predicting the winner. I'm just predicting the one that, until we get rid of this arcane 18th century electoral college system, the only democracy in the world that has such an antiquated system.
Mm-hmm.
Every other, I've even lived in other democracies like India and England and other places, and it's like it's popular vote, which would mean that everyone's vote counts. As it stands now, if you're in a state
yes.
like I am,
yep.
Yes.
I know exactly what you're going to say. If you're in California, let's say, we know that that state's going to go Democratic. So essentially, if you're a Republican, your vote's wasted, and vice versa.
Yeah, but if it was taken away from the states, if the whole concept of Electoral College, which was begun in the original 13 colonies, because they were more like sovereign nations
mm-hmm.
than in a union. Sending their representatives to choose the federal government. Well, now that, you know, your single vote in Guam would have more importance if there was no electoral college, because mm-hmm. every vote then would really count. Anyway, the thing is that I saw, there's two things that go on in prophecy, because prophecy is not written in stone. That's not been my experience. And there's a lot of examples in prophecies where prophets have seen a trend of the future that somewhat happened, but went slightly in a different direction. Classic example is that Nostradamus was called to court to explain his prophecy about jousting accidents taking the life of Henry II of France. We don't know how his audience went, but it was very positive, and I can only imagine that he also revealed to the king and queen, Catherine de' Medici and Henry II, that there was an alternative future where Henry would become a second Charlemagne. And you can see it in his prophecies, two very clear destinies, one in one quatrain of four lines and one in several quatrains. And what happened is that he said that in 1555, in 1559, Henry went into a jousting tournament and got himself killed. And that, of course, negated the other possibility. He was still young. He was only 41. And that negated, he was quite athletic and healthy before that, so he might have, even though that was not young in those days, he could have lived 20 more years. That other future never happened because his choices negated it. So you see that a lot in prophecy. And what you see in this current political campaign is the story of a man who would be president who is coming to his destiny too late, and a man who would be president who is coming to his destiny too soon. John McCain, his window, his destiny window, was the year 2000 election. Mm-hmm. If he had somehow managed to beat Bush and be the Republican candidate, I think he would have won. And it would be interesting because it would be just the right war president for a war against Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. And I don't think it would have ended in some quagmire in Iraq. But this is not the same McCain that we have today. And he is kind of in his descending destiny. Alternatively, Barack Obama is coming 4 to 8 years too soon to his destiny. That's actually a negative challenge to have because you're on the rise. So the potential is that he will just dig deep and find the ability, and if he's lucky, and if he chooses his cabinet well, he can speed up the process. He'll have to survive the next 2 years. The next 2 years are going to be incredibly difficult for everyone, very transformatory times, and also quite a pressure cooker for the president who will be Obama. If he survives, and I stress again, if he physically survives the first 2 years, he has the potential to catch up with the time of kind of bring his speed up his destiny and be this fulfillment of a very strange and unique karma of it's a triumvirate of three presidents, President Obama with the echo of Kennedy and the deeper echo of Abraham Lincoln. I'm going to write a book about his future that will come out next year at HogueProphecy.com. It's a digital PDF book, downloadable book, and it will look at this very interesting triumvirate. I mean, I haven't concluded on it yet, but I wouldn't at all be surprised if Barack Obama in some way has in his soul parts of the soul and incarnation of Abraham Lincoln in him, and that it's something very karmic about this presidency. The question is he going to echo the lessons come back for nations every 20 to 40 years, and we are definitely in a karmic echo to the 60s. And Barack Obama is sort of the echo of John Kennedy, and often when the echo happens, it's a reverse negative of the original image in future. I'll give you an example. Yeah, it's like we had 40 years ago, or 40 years ago, we had a Texan president who was a Democrat, who, on very flimsy information, rushed the nation to war in Vietnam.
Gulf of Tonkin.
Yes, and now, 40 years later, reverse image. The Texan president is a Republican, with the Republicans in power, just like back then it was the Democrats in power in the Congress, who rushed the nation into another Vietnam situation in Iraq on rather flimsy evidence. And there was very little debate. Everybody just stepped right into it again. So you had a JFK running for president in 1960. You had a JFK running for president in 2004, John Forbes Kerry, opposed to Jack Fitzgerald Kennedy, John Kennedy.
Sure.
You also have a Nixonian echo in Hillary Clinton. I often said that if she had made the presidency, I warned that I thought she would be president. I was saying it as far back as 1998, that she'd be president in 2008. She came very close, but I also added there was one caveat to this prophecy. One thing could take it away from her, and that's how she handled explaining and apologizing for her vote to give war powers to President Bush, which later led him into Iraq. I called it in some earlier Hoag Prophecy bulletins, which are on my website, and my Hoag Prophecy blog, which will soon be out. I called it Hillary Clinton's albatross. The rhyme of the ancient sea mariner is the metaphor for this, where she was kind of doomed to. She shot this bird. This was the character shot a bird that was with his arrow. It was a luck charm for the ship. And their luck, they got stranded, they were sailing the seas, it's cursed, and the guy had to wear the albatross around his neck. Then it was become the symbol of his mistake. And so it's used sometimes as somebody has an albatross from a bad decision. And I went on to say that, you know, she'd lose the anti-war movement, and Barack Obama would exploit it in the coming election. I talked about that in early 2007, before the primaries even began, almost a year before they began, in New Hampshire, saying that he would use it and exploit it, and it's the one way that she could lose her destiny to become president in 2008.
Yeah, I think that a lot of observers, myself included, were absolutely stunned that she did not eventually win the nomination. I mean, as time went on, you saw that it was a very real possibility. But at the beginning of the process, I think you'd be hard pressed to maybe to find anybody other than maybe Barack and Michelle Obama, and maybe not even them, who thought that he would be the nominee as opposed to her.
Yes, it was quite a momentum, and it's like that one thing, which I personally thought was not a biggie, but I was wrong about that. It ended up being that one caveat ended up being the issue, because she lost the anti-war vote. She also, now imagine another future timeline where Hillary Clinton had voted with the other 13 senators against the war powers. The primary would have had a different tone to it. She would be saying, not only do I have the experience, but when the going gets tough and life and death issues, which we vote on in the Senate, come forth, I went against the mainstream. I had the vision as well as the experience to say this was a disastrous war to get involved with. Obama, as a state senator in Illinois, going, I did too, would not make him look strong. But because she so Nixonianly moved along, almost cynically. It was really a moment of lapse of perception for her, because she was getting warned on all sides by the 13 that were there, one of them being my state senator in Washington State, that they were, and Al Gore and others were telling her that it's not a good thing. I did a bullet in the Albatross Bulletin. I used quotes from the very same October 2000 that these are friends of her colleagues. She knew these arguments were around, yet she mindlessly rushed into it. And it's one of those legacies that are similar to what's going to happen to the political futures of everybody in this October who voted for the bailout. That's going to be as significant for the political futures of many people who are going to be on the list for voting for this bailout.
And actually, that's an excellent transition. If you look at, the job of a president, there are two sides to it, and I'd like to talk a little bit about both as it pertains to America. And I guess we'll start with the domestic side, since you mentioned it. Of course, on everybody's mind right now is the American economy. The report today came on the GDP, gross domestic product, being down. I think most people agree that we are in a recession. Maybe not technically, but we pretty much are. What do you foresee for the American economy over the next couple of years?
American economy has to jump onto it. Has, the America in general, at large, has to do something that Americans are uniquely capable of doing when the going gets tough and it's a national emergency is perceived or a national opportunity is perceived. Americans, every so many decades, redefine themselves, recreate themselves. We did it when we went west. We did it through the blood-soaked years of the Civil War, when the American states became the United States are to the United States is. We changed the verb, and that's a redefining of what American is, as a national unit, not us a bunch of sovereign states. We did it in the arsenal of democracy, which is the last cosmic night period. We had to see a common enemy and galvanize the entire nation and its resources and its intelligence and its can-do qualities to fix it. We're in that again. The economy is just one facet in a growing number of crises that is going to hit the world, and its simple issue is sustainability. Since I've been writing in the early 80s, I've been warning in my writings and my books that the chief danger coming is the global climate change, overpopulation, the poisoning of the planet, and the concept that we can consume resources and grow in numbers, and that there's no limit to it. It's almost like if you want to look at something on the economic construct, it's like the housing market, where you just have this inflated bubble that people get loans with this concept that there'll be no end to it, that of course I can buy something with next to nothing because you know I project that 5 years later the economy will be even better, and then I'll sell it and make it back. This attitude, which hit really hard at last after 20 years of economics in America, kind of the bubble burst in October this month, there are similar bubbles that are about to burst concerning sustainability of products, of transport, of energy, and it's all interconnected to the economy. And we are in a crisis that's global, that is going to end up being far more significant than World War One and Two put together. And the opportunity is, and I see the signs, I predicted the signs in 2008 would start emerging, that Americans would start to get into being Americans about this emergency rather than Americans. And it is, you know, when you see T. Boone Pickens trying to proffer a plan, a general long-term energy plan, you see Al Gore from the other side, from the Democrat side, doing similar things and being listened to. You see T. Boone is Republican, Al Gore is Democrat. We see from both sides of the political spectrum, people are starting to understand that we are in this crisis. And I said that one of the biggest policies of Obama will be he will echo Kennedy in creating the 10-year race, the race for Earth stability, for climate stability, and fossil fuel freedom. He will declare that early in his presidency, like Kennedy declared a race to the moon. Well, this race is not against another country. This is a race to grab our future, grab our survival. And you will see this in this early on in this year, as you will also see, unfortunately, some major tests of Obama in the international arena, maybe as soon as February.
Well, that's interesting because Joe Biden, then there was quite a hullabaloo about it, came out and said, you know, if Barack Obama is elected, that he will be tested mightily and so on and so forth. And there was a lot made of that. So you're seeing the same thing. What form do you think the international challenges will take?
Well, there's two developing. The first is a kind of bridge burning that's will go on in the lame duck presidency of George W. Bush after November 4th. And one of the emerging crises that's going to be put before Obama is this attempt to force the Iraqi government of al-Maliki to sign this agreement that will allow U.S. bases to stay permanently, which will allow U.S. Forces to be able to strike neighboring countries and that the Iraqi sovereignty will not be in its way. The Iraqi leadership is saying, no, we're not going to sign it. The diplomats sent by the Bush administration has told them if they don't sign it, the American soldiers will go back in their barracks and everything will shut down. Nobody will do their security patrols and they're on their own. So it's blackmail. And if this thing doesn't get resolved and these bluffs and threats are not calmed down, you're going to have a situation where the surge will be undermined. And it could lead to more sectarian violence and the destabilization of Iraq by the time that Barack Obama is inaugurated as president. That's one of the possible crises coming. That is kind of self-induced by the departing American administration. The second one is a little more problematic and unexpected by a lot, because the next crisis is not going to come from an enemy of America, but from one of its staunchest friends. Just a few days ago, Kadima Party in Israel, run by Tzipi Livni, who was elected in September to be the head of the party, tried to form, well, has been trying for about 6 weeks to form a coalition government in the Israeli democracy. She, several days ago, announced to Shimon Peres, the president of Israel, that she cannot form a government and that elections should be held as soon as possible. Those elections will probably happen in February. Note again the importance of February, which is I describe in my bulletins, is an important Mars and Jupiter conjunction that comes up again and again as key and as a signpost of changes in this decade. And this is one of the last of the decade to happen. Happens a few weeks after inauguration. It talks in the prophecy about a new leader, king. Nostradamus speaks in our king language for modern leaders, who will be anointed or elevated or elected, who will bring peace to the earth for a long time. Now, he's either literally talking about an attempt to date the second coming of Christ, or he's talking about a messianic leader, or a messianic appearing leader. That could be Barack Obama. The thing is that this is all linked to a calamitous war under Cancer, he says, which is code in Nostradamus for a war, Mars, that's the conjunction, with Cancer, which is this country is a Cancerian country with a Cancerian President Bush currently. His calamitous war is happening on a number of fronts in Afghanistan, in Iraq, potentially expanding into Iran, and the fact that there has been no peace talks between the parties in the Middle East and the Arab-Israeli conflict for 6 years. No open peace talks, or that's stalled. The dividing of the Palestinians into Hamas and Fatah is kind of almost a civil, low-grade civil conflict between the Palestinians. All this has come, and all this could be exacerbated if Israel picks, who I believe they'll pick, the next prime minister is Benjamin Netanyahu, the former right-wing prime minister of Likud, who was for a time in the 90s the prime minister of Israel. He will win in a landslide in this election, because the Israelis feel that they're not living in a time where peace is happening. And in the cycles of Israeli politics, when the people feel that they're in a dangerous time, they don't pick peacemakers. They pick strong men like Ariel Sharon and others, because they say in the Middle East, and from my experience of being there, it seems true, people in the Middle East respect and listen and respond to strong people, strong actions. And it's not to, unfortunately, to seek peace is looked as weak during these times and something to be exploited. Now, that could all be changed by one very simple crisis, and here's the crisis that Obama will have behind closed doors. He will have to tell the Israeli government that the American foreign policy is no longer an adjunct of Israeli foreign policy, that it's understandable that Israel has sought that and gained that. Any country in Israel's position, I'm not putting Israel down for this, any country in their position would want to have a superpower do their bidding and make their strategic view of their region the same. But what's going to change with Barack Obama as president is that he is going to be a far more hard-loving and skeptical friend of the Israeli government. And I think that could go two ways. That could actually make it more difficult to get peace. It might also precipitate a desperate attack. I mean, one thing that on Iran.
Right. You know, that was my next question.
Yeah. Iran is highly, and I wrote last year, it was such a big issue that I wrote a digital book called Nostradamus, The War with Iran, where I looked at all the hypothetical possibilities of Nostradamian prophecy for such a war to happen. And there was a plan A and a plan B. Plan A shows America creating an incident and doing the bombing of the nuclear installations. Plan B is that the politics in America will not allow that because of Iraq and other things, and the Israelis then would have to rely on their own resources and do it before a sympathetic administration leaves office, or do it in the early stages of a new administration, not so sympathetic, but catch them off guard and do the deed and make the statement and then kind of force the issue on America to protect their chief ally in the Middle East. Backdoor attack on Iraq.
It's interesting because a lot of people forget this, but in the early 80s, the Israelis attacked Iraq with the nuclear reactors. And at that time, there was a great uproar and outrage. Perhaps in retrospect, that was not such a bad thing. But it is interesting to see how history repeats itself to some extent.
It does. And I talk about this whole issue of the Osirak attack outside of Baghdad. And when the Israelis dropped 2,000-pound bombs on a exploratory reactor that clearly Saddam Hussein was going to activate, and when he did, he'd make about 11 atomic weapons in a couple of years. And, you know, Israel has a unique problem in being a very small country, beset by potentially large enemies. Of course, it has to build an arsenal of weapons of mass destruction that's the biggest open secret in the Middle East. But what that does is, you know, you do that to save yourself, protect yourself, but you commit the same karmic mistake that America and Russia created. One of the big illusions that we're taught today is that somehow the Russians created the arms race, and the Americans get spoon-fed that. The fact is that the United States had built 250 atomic weapons by the end of 1940s when the Russians lit off their first bomb. In a way, what was going on between Iran and Israel reflects and echoes what went on in America and Russia creating this arms race. Israel seeks security, but it also creates a situation that if you've been in the Arab world or the Islamic world, you go, you know, it's a hypocritical playing field. We just talk about atomic power and we're ready to be bombed, but Israel is sitting on 200, 300, 400 atomic weapons, and everybody pretends they're not there who defends Israel. And, you know, whether you're for up a country or not, if you just step back from the emotions involved in this, that's just not fair play. And so, but what has to happen, and what Obama will have to do, and this will be a real test in his power, he's going to be dealing with a very right-wing, strong leader in Israel who has openly stated a few years back, he doesn't do it now because he's close to receiving power again, he openly stated that if he was put in prime ministership again, that one of his first actions would be to bomb the nuclear installations in Iran. So, you know, you know where he's coming from. Obama's going to have to use all of his diplomatic skills, perhaps with the help of former President Clinton and Carter, to be envoys to stop this from happening behind closed doors. And basically, he's going to have to say to Israel, if you do this, you're alone.
Interesting.
Unilateral action in the Middle East leads to disaster. Look what we just did.
Interesting.
But then Israel also needs from America and the world some kind of deterrent that basically says, and you'll hear this happen, if anybody just drops a single thing on Israel, that nation ceases to exist.
Interesting.
So, you know, yeah, so it's a, so, because Israel does need to be protected, but it's kind of created its own Hobson's choice and its own karmic, it has the potential. What I said in the book on Iran is that we had a Holocaust experience in the 40s where the Jewish communities did not anticipate it, could not fight it, and were nearly destroyed by it in Europe. And the trauma of that has created what could be potentially a swing too far to too aggressive behavior, which would trigger a second Holocaust, not by being too aggressive with your neighbors. A balance has to be achieved.
Well, after we get back from this break, I'd like to take an opportunity to talk to John about one of his areas of specialty, and that, of course, is the key figure of history named Nostradamus. While this man who lived hundreds of years ago continues to play such a large role on the world stage today, right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. For everybody that is hearing the sound of my voice after this show is over, do me a favor. If you're listening from your computer, go right to your favorite email program after this show and email one person you know who loves the paranormal like you do and tell them about the Paranormal Podcast. Include a link to paranormalpodcast.com. If you're listening on the go in your car, jogging with your iPod, do me another favor. Next time you get to a computer, open up your email program, email one friend about the Paranormal Podcast. It would help us greatly, and we'd really appreciate it. We're trying to get those numbers up, and they've increased 50% in October. So with your help, we can even go further. Now back to the show. Well, we're back on the Paranormal Podcast with what I think is one of the most interesting shows we've ever had. Our guest tonight is John Hoag. He is a scholar of prophecy. And in his work, a key figure in your career, John, has been that of Nostradamus. Now, the naysayers would proffer that he wrote in kind of these mystical quatrains that could be interpreted to mean anything. So people who interpret it just kind of move it around to fit whatever their pet theory is. First of all, a little bit of Nostradamus and kind of a little bit of how you would counter that that criticism of the skeptics.
It's a problem that even Nostradamus commented on in his own life. The explanation why he put his prophecies into a wild poetry, cryptic and verse. It was in part because he wanted to give enough of the future to change it, but not too much to actually make it worse. You got to remember that, and he probably foresaw it, that he foresaw his own prophecies probably being used as propaganda in World Wars One and Two. And ironically, the German propagandists under Goebbels used Nostradamus. They used real prophecies that did indeed predict the fall of France through the details that Nostradamus gave several centuries before in the 16th century. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you try to imagine if he was a little clearer and actually somebody like Saddam Hussein could have seen himself in the prophecies and said, oh, I better not attack Kuwait until I'm a nuclear power in 5 years. Then you have Armageddon. And who would be responsible for that? It would be Nostradamus for being too clear. So, in a way, that's one thing that happens. Now, of course, there's certainly a lot of the prophecies that are open to interpretation because he is quite vague. But he does this interesting thing. Just at the moment when you want to slam the book on and say, look, I'm tired of painting pictures of giraffes and turtles out of cloudy verse, you know, just like people when they lay on the grass, like, oh, that's a turtle, no, that's a giraffe. And there's a lot of that in Nostradamus. And then just when you're ready to give it up, he will come right out through the fog and say very clear things. For instance, he'll suddenly say, in October of 1727, he'll describe the Ottoman Empire and the Persian Empire coming to a peace agreement in that month. He'll describe what was passed in provinces and say that it would be detrimental to Christendom because two great powers of Islam would no longer be divided. he wrote that in the 1550s. It did indeed happen in October of 1727. There will be the situation where he described escape of Louis the 16th, who he said was a monk in gray caught at Varennes, that they would go past the forest of Rion, and he describes the map, the exact route that Louis the 16th and Marie Antoinette and their children took to escape the French Revolution. They were stopped in Varennes. He described Marie Antoinette as Queen White Stone. She was wearing a white dress, and the white stone is a play on the diamonds of the diamond necklace scandal, which was one of the big scandals that pushed the people over the edge against her. The monk in gray caught in Varennes, the king was dressed in the disguise of a Carmelite monk in gray. And then the final line is Narbonne and salsa. We have oil for our blades. Now, Narbonne was a revolutionary leader who's mentioned in another prophecy about the French Revolution openly. He was a friend of the king. Salsa, which is the old French spelling that Nostradamus would use for salsa, was the governor, the mayor of Varennes. He was an olive oil merchant. That's one example of the several hundred out of 1,500 prophecies. There are several hundred scattered through the prophecies that shine like bright lurid light and are not obscure, naming names, dates, spans of years. He talked about when the crop head would take from the short robe, he would then wear the long. 14 years his tyranny would last. Napoleon Bonaparte, when he became dictator of France after he overthrew the Directory, the French Parliament, wore a short-coated robe of the triumvir. There were three in the group, but he was actually the dictator. This was in 1799. In 1804, he adopted the long ermine robe of an emperor, became Napoleon I. From 1799 to his first abdication, which ended the Napoleonic Empire, he did come later in the Hundred Days to fight the Battle of Waterloo and then was exiled a second time. But that first span of years was 14 years. So it could go on and on all night with these. And one of the best is the thing long ago forgotten shall be rediscovered by Pasteur. He will be. This will take place when the lunar cycle reaches its completion. He shall be revered as a half-god man, a demigod. But through slanders as foul as and odorous, he shall be dishonored. There's only two times that the word Pasteur comes in prophecies of Nostradamus, which are 36,000 words in total. One is the Pasteur of Rome will do blah, 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 which means, okay, Pasteur of Rome, that's the Pope. But this Pasteur discovers something long ago forgotten, rediscovered by a man named Pasteur, which means he's a shepherd, or his name really is Pasteur. The key in unlocking what seems to be a vague prophecy is that your knowledge of cycles of astrology. Nostradamus, being an astrologer, talking about the grand lunar cycle, was talking about the one that existed during his era of life that would not end until the year 1889. 1889, then, is a key to find somebody named Pasteur who has a demiome or demigod as his nickname who is scandalized. Well, Louis Pasteur in 1889... the man who rediscovered germs caused disease and created the father of vaccinations, the great secret forgotten and rediscovered, was created the Institute Pasteur in the year 1889. The Encyclopedia Britannica of the time called him Demiome. That was his nickname, the demigod. And even though he was scandalized often during his own time, it wasn't until 1995 that you have the clear ending of this prophecy, when authors went back and researchers went back and restudied his handwritten notes and discovered that he was lying about testing his vaccinations on animals before he tested it on people. He actually tested it on street urchins, homeless children. And this kind of scandalized Louis Pasteur. It's a little bit of Dr. Mengele going on here. And so in all the steps, Nostradamus' prophecy is completely fulfilled.
Fascinating. And Nostradamus, again, probably one of the best-known references are the discussions of the Antichrists, the three Antichrists. And you've just recently come up with a new book called Nostradamus and the Antichrist, codenamed Mabus. Is that, and when? What is the book about?
It's very key times we're living in, because we're living in the times of the third and final Antichrist in Nostradamus' vision of the Antichrist, which is unique in Judeo-Christian tradition because he sees three, not one. And he codes their name in anagrams, word plays. The first was called Paul Ney Laurent, and those are three towns in southwest France. But the prophecy sounds very much like he's talking about Napoleon Bonaparte. So, Paul Ney Laurent, if you swivel the letters, becomes in French, Napoleon Noir, Napoleon King. And Napoleon, when he was born and up to his early years in France, called himself by his more Italian-sounding Corsican name, Napoleone Bonaparte, rather than Napoleon Bonaparte. That's the first Antichrist in Nostradamus' opinion. The second Antichrist is named after the ancient name for the river Danube, Hister. And he uses a thing to describe a man in five prophecies that Hister shows up. And in them, he's also matched with Barb or Barbarossa. Now, that sometimes has played on, that means red beard, and it's been played on some other prophecies about an Islamic corsair pirate that was a contemporary of Nostradamus' time. But in this context, it sounds like something that deals with World War II and Hitler. Those historians of World War II understand, in your audience, that the invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941 was codenamed Barbarossa.
Yes, Operation Barbarossa, yes.
Yeah, Redbeard. And in the same prophecy where Hister appears, he keeps talking about the importance of Malta, how Malta would suffer what sounded like bleeding out of the eyes and nose and ears of those of Malta. Sounds like concussion bombs. Malta was constantly bombed during World War II by the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, because it was a island held by the British that they used to sink ships that gave supplies to the Africa Corps in North Africa. And it was because of those shipping lanes being bombed by planes off Malta that the North African venture ended. So it's here you've got the Hister name with the events in Russia and the events of overextension in North Africa and Russia applied to in a prophecy that also talks about angry Irale. Irale is a classic anagram for Israel. He talks about the captives sent into the furnace. In the same prophecy, Nostradamus was born a Jew, converted, his family converted to Christianity, but he was ever in the underground of Jewish mysticism. And it was something he foresaw, the Holocaust, Hitler as Hister, Barbarossa as the invasion of Russia, and the importance of Malta in the Mediterranean theater of World War II. So in this book, Nostradamus and the Antichrist, I go step by step through what is really what I call a sleuth-saying detective story, where we try to look at the leads Nostradamus gives in his word plays. You follow words like effrayer for terror, and it takes you through his prophecies, which are all delivered out of sequence to confuse it even more. Prophecy can be in four or five verses spread across 10 volumes. But if you know the word links and the patterns of Nostradamian speech, and if you understand the importance of classical metaphors in Nostradamus' mindset, you unlock amazing things that look at Napoleon, Hitler, and then this third person called Mabus, M-A-B-U-S. Now, Mabus is converts into some very interesting names. If you take into Roman phonetics, the proper pronunciation of Usama bin Laden, you get U-S-A-M-A. In anagrams, you do it all in lower case, M-double-A-U-S is only missing the B. You have a redundant A replaced the B. You can do that in Nostradamus anagrams. So there's Mabus. Now, you can take Saddam Hussein, and you take Mabus and do what's called in anagrams a reverse image. Mabus becomes a Subam. You can reverse letters, if it's possible, into other letters. B's become D's. Sudam. If you look at the Arabic explanation or pronunciation of Saddam, it's Saddam. It's Dam. Saddam. All you need to do is add, so that's a long A, you get Saddam. It's right there. The third interesting crunching of letters is G.W. Bush for George W. Bush. Even the current president translates into Mabus. Lowercase G.W. B.U.S. Flip over the G.W., you get M.A. B.U.S. with a silent H. Drop the irrelevant H, you get Mabus. The one that is the most disturbing to a lot of people, and probably the bone of controversy in this book, is that perhaps the future president of the United States, Barack Obama, also sees his name very easily convert following the laws of anagram. And I know some Obama supporters are very angry with me for putting him in the list. But, you know, my personal views about who I vote for or not is not a part of this. This is 30 years of scholarship, of understanding the important signs. And I would be remiss as a scholar of Nostradamus not to look at even those things that popularly do not feel good or go against the grain of what people hope or wish. I would also say that as a prophecy scholar, one has to look at that rather uncomfortable reality that if your Antichrist is really going to deceive you, he's not going to have a little Charlie Chaplin mustache. He's going to be somebody that you love, you know. And so, but that, unfortunately, when I say that, then people take the jump and say, oh, you're calling Obama the Antichrist. No, I'm saying that is an option you have to look at. I also, in the book, show, I make an argument for all the chief candidates and equally make an argument to completely deconstruct them as the candidates.
Oh, that's a fascinating way to do it. That's very, very interesting.
And then at the end of the book, just to close on this, is I take from the personification search that Nostradamus got so obsessed with in his prophecies, I take the reader into something that's more intimate and immediate and more solvable. A way that we can end the Antichrist in the world is to see how each of us, through our programming and conditioning, have been kind of turned into habitually servants of those same unconscious forces. I call this the ultimate true Antichrist, as far as I'm concerned, is the Antichrist unconscious. And I end the book with showing ways on how this most subtle of Antichrist is the easiest to break free of. And if each individual does that, it changes the climate of the world where Antichrist cannot tread.
If you look into the work that you've done, you know, and you don't even have to look into prophecy. You can look at the newspaper, the internet, the television. You see war. You see, ecological problems. You see a worldwide banking system and economy on the brink of disaster if we're not already there. Now, you kind of see all this from a unique perch because you have the overlay of prophecy in your study. Are you optimistic or pessimistic, and why?
I am neither. I am transhumanistic. I'm notorious for my hogisms. I create words. Basically, consciousness, which is opposed to anti-consciousness, anti-Christ, symbolic of the consciousness in us, or the potential of Christ consciousness in us, is something that's transmoral. It's something that's beyond good and evil. It's something beyond optimism and pessimism, hope and hopelessness. There is a whole plethora of prophecies from more rebellious prophets that I've been kind of a champion of over these years. Prophets who did not actually see a future the mainstream likes in their time, but they couldn't be denied their accuracy, documented accuracy. I've gathered and defended those prophets in a lot of my books, and they see collectively a vision of a new humanity that's going to come out of the very crisis that we've entered in 2008 that will be with us for at least 36 years.
Well,
it's an evolutionary crisis.
Well, I think that there's plenty more to talk about, and hopefully you'll be able to come back on the show at a future time, and we'll talk more. Now, if folks want to find out more about John Hoag, his prophetic interpretations, where would they go?
Well, you go to hoagprophecy.com. That's my website. You can join the Hoag Prophecy Bulletin. I'm soon going to have a blog, Hoag Prophecy Blog, that's just being set up now. And you can check that by going to hoagprophecy.com/predictions to see that. You spell Hoag like rogue. It's with an H. H-O-G-U-E, or what I like to say, hog with a U-E on it. and you basically there, I as part of the future, being part of the future, part of the process, I've cut way back from printing physical tree-made books. I now try to sell most of my books in digital form so that what I'm using is photons and electrons that you purchase. You get a fully illustrated book that you can immediately after purchase download onto your computer, and then if you so wish, you can print it out for reading, or you can read it on a laptop or your computer, as many people do in the new generations. And it is the way of the future for books. And so I have a number of these, as well as some of my physical books, for sale at hoagprophecy.com. And I answer all my emails, and I get about 5,000 a year.
Wow. Well, you were certainly very prompt in answering our email, and I'm so glad you did, and you took a great deal of time tonight to talk to us. Thank you very much, and I hope we can do this again.
Oh, I predict we'll do many of these, Jim.
Very good. And I predict that we have an election coming up. And just a word for all of those in the United States, this is a crucial election for us, whether you're a liberal, conservative, left or right. So please go out, exercise your franchise and vote. I'm not going to tell you who I'm going to vote for, but I will tell you I'm going to vote. So please do. And until next time, I'm Jim Harold for the Paranormal Podcast. Good night.